Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
Hi, I'm Serge. I use he, him pronouns. Welcome to Libre Lounge. For those listeners who've been listening for a while and wondering where Chris is, Chris has left the mountaintop and is now somewhere in the rainforest. I think they're picking up mushrooms or flora or something. They're going to tell us all about that when they get back in a few weeks. But we're really lucky to be to have Frank Itzchek from Nextcloud on. So welcome, Frank.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here. It's actually one of my favorite podcasts. So
it's so sweet.
Yeah, it's true. So it's great to be here. Yeah.
So I've been using Nextcloud for I think about 2 years, and I heard an amazing talk by Frank at LibrePlanet 2019 called "Why I Forked My Own Project and My Own Company." For people who haven't used Nextcloud, I'm going to save Frank the work of having to explain his own product again. Nextcloud is basically a personal or team synchronization tool. It does file synchronization like Dropbox is the big proprietary thing that most people have used. It does calendaring similar to, for example, Google Calendar. It does Office integration now with OnlyOffice, and before that Collabora, which was LibreOffice. So you can use it. It has a million plugins. It also has a video audio plugin, kind of like Google Hangouts. So it basically takes care of all of those tasks. I use it every day for my own file synchronization across devices, and also for to-do list management partially and project management. So I'm a big fan. And so when I saw Frank's talk about the way that what was previously OwnCloud became Nextcloud, I was really interested, and I would really love to start there. If you could give just a little bit about that process, and you know, I'll link to the talk, but just kind of if you could condense it, I think that's a great place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an interesting story, and it's also a complex story, and there's so many different aspects. So, yeah, I recommend to watch the talk, but I can try to summarize it, but it's it's not easy because there's so many aspects. But yeah, I mean, OwnCloud is a software with a similar idea that I founded 10 years ago. So I think 3 weeks ago there was the 10 years anniversary, and at the time I was still like super active in the KDE community. And we did a conference in San Diego at the time, and people asked me to give the keynote. And at this event, I basically launched OwnCloud, and was at the time still part of the KDE project, but that later became more independent. But yeah, that's something I launched. I picked the HGPL as license, as a pure free software, open source project. And yeah, I wrote the version 1.0 alone, but very quickly there was a community and people contributed. We did like the first meetups, and it was growing. And then as a pure hobby project, as a pure volunteer driven project. And then I think 1.5 years later, the idea popped up, because it really became more and more popular. The idea popped up that maybe there's an opportunity to somehow find a way to actually pay the volunteers and create like a company. By the way, for me, the company was never a purpose. It was never really the purpose to have a company. The purpose was to have like something that can help the contributors to drive like the software and the project faster forward. And of course it helps if people are paid to do the development. And then, yeah, I got in contact with two other people, and together we founded like a company around the project. And we did this for a while, but it didn't really work out for many reasons. wrongly.
I mean,
people.
To summarize, yeah. I think the part for me was that, you know, you went with the, well, we'll call it the traditional Silicon Valley model. So you had a bunch of developers, you did some initial launch, then you brought in a bunch of venture capitalists who would inject your company with money, and that is kind of the standard procedure, right? You get a bunch of venture capitalists, and then you encountered that the model that the company was going, the open core model, and which is that you have this free software project, and then you have these add-ons, and these add-ons are proprietary. You know, the way you explained it was, well, this puts our users at conflict with our company, because now you're always trying to push them toward the proprietary thing, which means that you as a company are less incentivized to make free software. Because now you're competing with yourself, and your users are competing with you, and so there's of course the venture capitalists who want their investment back are always going to push for the thing that's going to, in their minds, bring them the greatest value as quickly as possible.
Yeah, no, that's a great summary. So, I mean, the decision at this point was to not grow organically, but to accept venture capital money. Exactly as you said. And then, of course, well, then you need like a really lucrative, very fast scaling business model. And yeah, people convinced me that open core and dual licensing and some other things were great business models. And then exactly led to the conflicts that you just mentioned. That so what feature is then open source, and what feature is in the enterprise version only, and competing with itself? And then at the end of the day, I mean, the open source community free software version was always something like the marketing trial version, so something that people should use. But if they really want to use it, they really should become a customer and you need to buy this other version, which is completely proprietary. Yeah, and there are many, many problems with this model. And at the end, it really didn't work out. And that, yeah, led to the situation that the company didn't make enough money. The customers were like confused because they thought they're buying some free software product, but then if they buy the enterprise edition, it's not free software anymore. And the developers were disappointed. The volunteer community basically left because they were like confused. Oh, what is this proprietary software thing that we're doing? And yeah, it didn't really work out. And then, yeah, a normal company would actually be just go bankrupt. But because there was still the core, which was free software, there was the opportunity to fork it. And this led to the title of the talk, Why I Forked My Own Project and Company. That's what we did with Nextcloud now. And now we have a pure free software business model. We don't do this open core stuff anymore. And yeah, surprise, surprise, it actually works better.
I mean, the other piece of the talk that I thought was so interesting, I mean, you've already identified everything, which is that this open core model eventually leads to a conflict of treating the free software version as kind of like shareware, right? Like, oh, try it before you buy it. But then the thing that the customers actually get is never the thing that they actually were trying.
Right.
Because now you've got all these proprietary components in, and you as a company are disincentivized to work on the free one. And you also mentioned some specifics in that talk, which again we'll link to, of, oh, well, I couldn't accept patches and plugins from the community because they were in conflict with the proprietary products that we were selling. Which is the perversion here. The other thing
that's
you mentioned
totally stupid,
was that you talked about how you don't go with the hosting model. So there's no way you can, there's nothing that Nextcloud sells. It's like Nextcloud branded hosting. And you explained in that talk that the problem with the hosting model is that it also puts a disincentive to make the software easy to install.
Yes. The hosting model is not interesting thing. There are so many aspects to it. First of all, it makes it hard to install, exactly. So because, I mean, the purpose of OwnCloud at the time and now Nextcloud is to enable people to host or to run the software as they want. That's the goal. And once you basically provide hosting yourself, you're somehow working against your own mission in a way. And that's a bit weird also, because there's also some idealistic background. I mean, I started OwnCloud and I'm doing NextCloud now because I want to decentralize the internet. I want to decentralize cloud services, right? And if we would then offer like the whatever official centralized version, then that's a bit weird. So we don't do that. We focus on building the software and other people should actually run it.
I think that's one of the most complicated, at least for me, one of the most complicated bits. So Nextcloud makes its money the way you explained it, and you're here to correct me, of course, is that you use essentially the Red Hat model, which is that you sell, you give away the software, and anyone can use it and run it. Like I'm a Nextcloud user. I don't pay you anything for Nextcloud, but if I want support, and we can define what support is in terms of, you know, either technical support or maybe new features or whatever, Nextcloud is available for that, which means that you're focusing on the small top 10% of your businesses. Yep. And large customer, large users who have the money to spend, but they're essentially subsidizing the rest of development for everyone like me.
Yeah, no, that's true. Of course, subsidizing you is not easy, because software, there's no cost in copying the software, right? So if you use it or not, doesn't cost any money, right? So basically giving it away for free for everybody is like cost nothing. That's one of the great things with software. This is why we can do it. And the model is really a bit like, as you mentioned, Red Hat, because there's CentOS, which is basically the same than RHEL. And a lot of people use it, and it's great. And the idea is that once you are really big and really depend on the software, maybe you're a bank or a government or some huge enterprise, and you really want to have a support contract with a phone number and like guaranteed long-term support and some other things that you really want, then you can get a RHEL subscription. And the software doesn't really change that much. It's really the same as CentOS, but you have all these guarantees and these legal things around it. And this is what big companies want. And that's similar to what we do.
Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. In some ways, though, you know, the difference here is that you're not even doing the CentOS version, because CentOS is made by a third party by stripping out all the Red Hat trademarks and name and replacing them with the CentOS, you know, white label. Whereas you're actually just giving away the whole thing and saying, well, if you really want it with the support contracts, you can come to us with a support, you know, and we'll offer you a support contract.
What the CentOS people are really doing, they only remove the trademark. The rest is really the same. So the trademark is a bit, I don't know. I mean, I think Red Hat has a bit weird situation that they have, because I think nowadays they even own the CentOS trademark and they also own the Red Hat trademark, obviously. And I think there might be historical reasons. I don't see a reason why it shouldn't be called the same somehow.
Yeah, I think that's I wasn't aware that they owned the CentOS trademark. That's interesting.
Yeah, no, they took over the complete project.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But yeah, they did it. And not to kill it, actually to sponsor it. It's really interesting. So because as a classic business person, you might think, well, all these people, they use our software without paying us. That's bad. No, it's not. It's not bad at all.
Right, because as you said, it's a zero marginal cost item. So, you know, whether there's one rich king, right? Like I'm imagining this is, you know, hundreds of years ago where you had a patron, right? Like a patron monarch who just said, "Oh, I'm going to pay for your work for the rest of your life." Mm. Or whether it's, you know, a million people sending in a penny, it's the same.
Yeah.
Right? It costs the same to make the work.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it is interesting. And then you gave a talk that I haven't seen yet because I wasn't at FOSDEM about the GPL and this pushback by you know, companies who making these non-free licenses. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the perfect question now after the discussion of the Red Hat model. Because, I mean, first of all, the Red Hat model and also the Nextcloud model, I think this is the most successful free software business model out there. I mean, really, I mean, Red Hat is obviously, I mean, now owned by IBM, of course, but still, until a few months ago, was the most successful and biggest free software open source company in the world. So obviously, this is working well. And a lot of other companies have the same model. Well, some have the open core model, and we talked about that, but it's a very successful model. The thing is that since a few years, we have this weird thing called cloud computing, right? And this is, it just changes a few things because you no longer really buy software and install it on your servers in your basement. You don't no longer do this. Of course, with free software, you never buy software, but you buy other stuff like support subscription, as we just discussed. But the thing is that you no longer have these servers in your basement. What you do nowadays, you buy a service from Amazon and Google Cloud and Microsoft and so on. And you go to those companies, say, hey, I want to have a database as a service or storage as a service or some other stuff as a service. And if you do this, no one really needs a support contract anymore, right? If you get like MariaDB or MySQL as a service from Amazon, that's all you need. You don't go to MariaDB and buy a support contract. And also Amazon doesn't pay for that because they have enough engineers to run it themselves. So there's the danger that this threatens the most successful open source free software business model, this trend.
So I'm not going to ask you to give away all the talk, but these companies have while I don't agree with their conclusion, right? So their conclusion is essentially to make a non-free license.
Exactly.
So that's not a good solution. But on the other hand, the threat that they present from that they're showing us from these large providers, the Amazon and Google's, and Microsoft, those are real. They really can just destroy a company that is making its money, that it's making high quality free software that is based on a support contract by simply cutting out the support contract and making it irrelevant. So what is the solution? I mean, you must think about this because Nextcloud, right?
Nextcloud. I mean, let's see how it goes, but we are theoretically in a similar situation, right? I mean, someone can take Amazon can take Nextcloud and, I mean, call it, I don't know, Amazon Cloud and offer it as a service. And if this really becomes really popular and big, then we don't make any money anymore and we have to fire the developers. So that's definitely a threat. What those other companies do, the Redis and the MongoDB guys, to change the license, that's definitely, as you said, that's not the solution. This is like, we are trying to save open source by killing it, or basically make everything non-free software anymore. That's not the solution, obviously. It's a really tough problem. I don't have a really good answer. I mean, in my talk at FOSDEM, I made a few points that if you're really a true free software product and true free software company, you still have like many, many advantages. For example, that you usually have a very active contributor community who come to you and help you with building the software because you're on the same playing field than everybody else. That's guaranteed by the GPL. And if you have these weird business models, these proprietary ones, I mean, they usually require that you sign a CLA, contributor license agreement. You need to give the company special rights about your software. And there are many, many other things, which I think at the end harms the product and the community and everything, the whole idea. And if this happens, then well, then you're also out of business in a way. So we are trying to basically just build a nice software and a good community and a good product and everything. And then I think, I mean, as discussed before, it's not required for us to get like everybody as a paying customer, right? We are happy with only getting like 0.1% of our users to pay us, because they're usually big organizations and they probably wouldn't buy Amazon SuperCloud 3000 from Amazon or something. They want to have the real thing. So
that's, I do wonder about, you know, the one area about this that I think about sometimes is when I used to work with questioncopyright.org, which is a nonprofit dedicated to free culture. One of the projects that they were working on and that never really took off, but I think had a lot of potential, is this idea of creator endorsed. And it was the idea that if you were releasing free culture, so they were talking about music and films, mm-hmm. and things like that, that you would have a trademark icon that companies that wanted to sell your work could put. And mm-hmm. it would basically say, well, this is creator endorsed, which means that, you know, so let's talk about without that. So without that, you know, I could just make a whole bunch of CDs and sell some free music on Amazon, mm. right? I don't need permission to sell somebody else's stuff. That's what makes it free culture.
Yeah.
But that's a crappy thing to do, right? Much nicer would be, well, for every CD, I'm going to give $1 or $2 to the creator, yeah. some percentage. So the idea was that we would encourage good behavior by saying, well, if you want to have this creator endorsed mark, which would work kind of like when you go to the store and you say, oh, this is certified organic or free trade, right? People look for those, mm-hmm. those things. This would mm-hmm. be the same. Not everyone's going to look for it, but some percentage of people are going to look for it. And when they see it, they're going to go, oh, okay, good. This means that it's getting returned, you know, some amount of money is getting returned back to the creator.
Yeah.
And I wondered why we in the software community don't do something like that. Like, so, okay, mm-hmm. you might have Amazon Database 3000, but it's, you know, for trademark reasons, it's not going to be called MariaDB. It's not going to be called this. And maybe people should be looking for that, or at least some discerning customers should be looking for mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. I don't have a good answer, but it's easy to blame the business people, right? So I think I blame the business people here a bit, because this is something I experienced in the past, like in the former project and company. Because once you have like venture capital in the company, you have all these reports and you have all these numbers, and one of the numbers is something called a conversion rate. And the idea was always like, yeah, we give away the software for free for everybody. And what's the percentage? What's the conversion rate that we actually get as a paying customer? And this was something that was always talked about. And this was always something that people tried to optimize. And I think this is complete BS. I mean, in the software world and the internet world, something like conversion rate, that's a totally wrong concept, because it's very easy. I mean, for us as Nextcloud, it's very easy to bring the conversion rate to 100%, right? We just stop being free software, and we right. make it everything. We make everything proprietary, and then 100% of our users pay us. Great.
Right.
So that's easy, but that's totally the totally wrong metric. And also it's like, I don't know. I mean, because it's software and distributing it and running it, because you run it, right? It's not running on our server, it's running on your server. This costs absolutely nothing. So if we have like 1,000 people who run Nextcloud without paying us, or 10 million or 100 million or a billion people, really doesn't cost us anything. So the more the better. And everything we need is, I don't know, everything we need as the Nextcloud company is like, whatever, 200 big companies paying us, right? Then we're happy. That's all we need, right? It's not that much.
Right.
And because everybody else using it for free, well, it maybe hurts the, I don't know, the calculation of the venture capitalists and the business people, but at the end of the day, yeah, it's great. I mean, I don't think there's a problem.
I mean, I'm gonna take this very unpopular position of not defending venture capital, but I guess one of the things about a lot of people who are not business people is that they don't even understand what venture capital is. And mm-hmm. all it really is that you have a bunch of people who have extra cash. They don't mm-hmm. want to put it in the regular stock market. They want to take a risk. And yeah. by investing in a small business is risky. Most businesses go out of business in a few years. So because the risk is higher, they need the return to be higher. And
exactly.
And so they're motivated by, well, you know, if four out of the five businesses that somebody invests in fails, that means mm-hmm. that in order to make their money back, the fifth one must do so amazingly well
yes.
that it beats out the four that failed.
Yep.
Which puts this artificial constraint on the one survivor to not just, you know, to essentially, you know, make up for the, you know, I'm imagining like a swimmer, and you have this mm. person who's swimming, and he's the only one who survived, but he's dragging on these four dead bodies, right? Well, yeah. you have to swim five times better to make up for how bad everybody else did, and mm. you know, there. So it makes sense that they're not, you know, wringing their hands, you know, like Mr. Burns mm. style. They're just going, oh, but in order to make up for how poorly everybody else did, I have to get this one to do super, super well. So
yeah, yeah.
It makes, I mean, everybody here is acting rationally, you know, we're all rational actors. It's just not a
sure.
good, it's just not a good fit for organic growth, right? It creates this artificial constraint of, well, and also, you know, when you sign up for venture capital, they're what they're giving you is money and maybe some connections. So they're going, okay, well, we're going to give you $1 million, let's say. And then they're going to want to know, well, what are you using the $1 million for? Hey, are you going to use it to hire people? Are you going to use it to market or what are, you know? And so, and they get worried about their money. And so they go, well, what do we do? Well, maybe we should get reports because reports mm-hmm. make us feel like we're in control. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I basically always tell people exactly what you just said. So, I mean, but I disagree at the end because it's relatively easy. People would be shocked how easy it is to get like 1 million of investment. It's nowadays, it's actually quite easy. The only thing you need to tell them is that they're going, that they will get like 10 million back in 3 years, right? And then the factor of 10 is, as you just said, is because like lots of companies go out of business. So the one that survives needs to be super, super profitable. So basically for us to accept like 1 million or 2 million of investment, and then we have to promise them they get like 20 million back in 3 years. That would be quite easy. But the problem is, how can we ever pay that 20 million back?
Right.
I mean, that's like impossible. I mean, you need to, I don't know, invent a money printing machine or become the next Facebook or Google or whatever. Like for a normal company, it's like not really possible. So you need
that's
to
right.
come up with these crazy business ideas that are most of the time not working anyways. And it's really, I don't know. And for us, it's like, I mean, I did this like in the old days, as I mentioned earlier, but this is not working together with the free software community, because free software is really about sustainability and about volunteers and I don't know, everybody in the same playing field and being like one entity in this game who is like, yeah, and next year we want to have whatever, several hundred millions of revenue. So this is,
I mean, I'm going to stick
working.
On money a little bit, even though, you know, I think most of the people who listen to this are not very money motivated, and I'm not super money
yeah.
motivated, but
exactly.
you know, the what's happening is, you know, even of the examples you gave, you know, most of these big companies that we hear about, they don't actually make a huge profit, you know, like Uber only had, I think, was one or two quarters of profit. Other than that, they've been losing money. Twitter was around for
yeah.
like a decade before it made a profit. And the
right.
problem, and so they go through these, what, you know, they call, you know, for people who aren't business people, they go through these funding rounds, which is, well, you know, hey, investors, give us more money. with the idea that we're going to be more profitable one day. And all they're doing, it's like they're pushing back the day of profitability more and more and more in favor of growth, right? They're like, well, the more we grow, the more money we'll get one day. But when that day comes, they have to be super, super profitable. And and the way that they've been doing that is by pursuing, these growth numbers, these adoption rates that are astronomical. Whereas what you pointed out is that, well, actually, if you go for organic growth where you only have a certain number of employees, you know, a handful of employees, maybe 10 or 15, you can have 200 customers. And it's much easier to manage 200 customers than, you know, than 2 million customers. Your overhead in handling them is easier too. So, you know, I think one of the challenges I have is that, you know, we have a lot of people who are anti, you know, business, just pure business is bad. And I don't, I don't believe business is bad. You know, this is a weird divergence, but, you know, as someone who's, and I'm not bringing this up because you're German, but my family's German too, you know, and when my family was killed in World War II, you know, people that had money were able to use it to escape. And that's always been my feeling about money, is that you need it because it's your safety net. So against totalitarianism. I mean, that's my, which is, I know they're not the opinion that a lot of people have, but that's always been my thought is, well, if we had had money, we wouldn't have, you know, if my grandfather had not lived on a potato farm, maybe they could have escaped, right? So I personally think about these, not to be, you know, super opulent rich, you know, so that you have 20 yachts, but that maybe if things go sideways, you can get the hell out. You know, I do think about business and money, and I think about the ways that we can do these things in a way that is still ethical. And I think that this pursuit of humongous growth, you know, of, well, let's get everybody, let's do a conversion rate of 100% with a million people, is what's driving these unethical practices, because now you have these venture capitalists, they're flush with cash, and all that means is that rich people don't have a good place to make money. They don't feel like the market is giving them enough return. They have extra cash, and they're like, well, what am I going to do with it? My 5% return, you know, from the S&P 500 is not sufficient, so I want to make 10 or 20%. Well, okay, I'll give it to venture capitalists in you know, doing private work. Well, the private work, 4 out of 5 businesses fail, so now the one remaining one has to do, you know, has to do better than all the other ones combined, plus plus, and so on and so on. So that's, I think that's where things get perverted. But and as you said, sorry, go on.
No, this is I totally agree, and that's, you made excellent points. So I think, because at the end of the day, it's, at the end of the day, the question is, what do you want? I mean, I don't know what to get, becoming super philosophical, but at the end of the day, I mean, we only have a few years to live, right? And the question is, what do you want? What do you want to do? What do you want to be? What do you want to build? What should be your legacy, right? And of course, I mean, there's money is important because it helps to pay the bills and to pay for your family and everything. But of course, I can only talk about me. There's also the idea that you want to do something positive. You have to have a positive impact. Yes. And this is something that, I mean, I always find it interesting. Since I started software development when I was 10 years old or something, it fascinates me that as a software developer, you can do interesting things that actually change the world. This is because other people can't really do that. I mean, if you have another job, it's really hard to have something, a positive impact. But as a software developer, you can sit in your basement and on your own, you can write software that changes the world. And that's always something that I find super fascinating. And then when I got in contact with like free software and open source community, with KDE, for example, I was involved in the KDE community for a long, long time. I find it super interesting that this community, this worldwide community, came together and building the software that is threatening like Microsoft. Right? I mean, and it's just that people who never met in person and that they got no money out of it because, but it's software over the internet. It's possible to do that. And this fascinates me. What one thing that was a bit of a problem with the KDE community is that people always dropped out of the community because a lot of people do this as a student and that's a fun hobby. And then when they became basically started their real job, then you had to, then they all became like proprietary software developers and are gone for the free software movement somehow. And I always thought, wouldn't it be great to somehow being able to keep on doing this and do it full time? And this is, for example, the motivation for me to start this company in the first place.
Yeah. Right?
Because it's not really to optimize my bank account, because honestly, I don't know, if this would have been my goal, I would have, I don't know, started to work for Google or Facebook for many, many years ago already. But that's not really, I don't know, that's not what I want to do.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, you touch on two important things. So I had a similar experience, although I haven't developed as much software. When I was a teenager, I was very depressed. I've talked about this on previous shows. And the thing that helped pull me out of it was this idea in free software of you don't need permission from anyone, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you want to make this? Go ahead and make it. You're in control. It's like the ultimate democracy of you don't even have to worry about what other people are doing. You just have to follow a few rules about licenses that say, oh, don't be a jerk, be nice to everybody, work together, and then you can almost do what you want. And that really affected me. And when I thought about these questions, you know, about like, oh, how are we going to make money? This was in the 90s, you know, Linus Torvalds had a saying, and he said, well, everybody needs a car, but not everybody needs a Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I agree, you know, we can do something meaningful with our lives that's going to be helpful and give back and do something that's greater than ourselves. The challenge is that we still have to, we have to have the resources in order to be able to do that. So I want to shift from this philosophy actually to something else you said, which is, you know, this larger issue of silos on the internet. Nextcloud is wonderful. I use it, but I think about the fact that Nextcloud is in a sense a silo, right? So I have my files and my other resources, you know, my to-do list, my Kanban deck, etc. But mm-hmm. they don't really connect with your Nextcloud instance, right? They can only talk to each other in the most primitive ways right now. But I'm really curious because I know that you've worked on and you've been involved tangentially in ActivityPub, for example, and where you think that's going.
Mm-hmm. No, excellent, excellent question. So I think, I don't know. Should I start the big philosophical question already, or talk about technology later?
I actually think that the philosophy informs the technology.
I totally agree. So the thing is, I don't know. I'm a political person. I'm interested in politics, and I am afraid that we might live, or our children, I don't know, in a centralized, I don't know, dictatorship in the future, because software and IT and the internet is so powerful that if it used wrongly in the wrong way, then it can be really used to, I don't know, really change society. And I'm really afraid of that. And you can see a little bit tendencies in, like in China and other places where you have this social scoring system and like controlling of all the communication. And that's a bit of a danger. And this, of course, for me, this is really sad, because when I grew up, and I first like saw the internet, I thought, well, that's like that's a huge force for good.
Yeah.
Because it helps to connect everybody on this planet. Like everybody can communicate and everybody can share knowledge. Right. Of course, everybody will be super educated because the information is like available for free. And if I can like communicate and chat and do video calls with everybody, there will be no wars anymore because there will be so much empathy because we are all like connected somehow.
Yeah. That's what I thought. It's funny. You know, it's funny you mentioned that there was obviously you're not the first person to think this, right? I mean, about the internet, but you know, I think about I'm somewhat of a geek who thinks about languages, and there are these two conlands, right? So artificial constructed languages. The first one that I actually know is Esperanto, right? And the idea of Esperanto is, well, if everyone just learns Esperanto, we'll all communicate with one another. And then if we communicate with one another, then there'll be peace because then there won't be any misunderstanding. And then one that you may not have heard of is Bliss. And it was actually made by a German Jew coming out of World War II. And he felt that it was a set of symbols, and his idea was that the reason that totalitarianism happens is that people lie, and if you create a language in which people cannot lie, in which there is no room for ambiguity like this, then there will be no war because everyone will always have to tell the truth, and then there'll be peace forever. You know, when I grew up, I think we're around, and I'm in my early 40s, and I think we're roughly the same age. And, you know, the idea of the internet for me, sorry about the sirens, I live in New York City. You know, was around the same idea, which is that, if we're all connected, then we'll all rise to the highest level, right? We'll all watch. I can't remember what it's called now. The Salman Khan. What's his? His like free university. We'll all watch all the free university videos. So we'll all be super educated. We'll all speak all the different languages, and maybe we'll have a common language. All you know, all the cultural misunderstandings will melt away, and we'll all be at peace, right? And I agree with you that there's a risk that what we're seeing is, A, that's not what's happened. If anything, it's gotten worse, right? If it's we've become less, and these information silos in the form of big companies and government restrictions have made things even more dangerous.
Exactly. So this is exactly what I wanted to say, that these huge data silos, they are a gigantic threat, and they are a really big risk for, I don't know, turning this whole world into a huge dictatorship somehow. I really, even if like the current, I don't know, if like the Google and the Facebook and the Microsoft of the world are, I don't know, not super evil at the moment, but at some point it will be misused, and you can see this in other countries already. So I don't know. And this is, there are several things that can be done here. I mean, you can go into politics, but I'm not a good politician, basically. this is not what I do. But I'm a software developer. So I thought, well, maybe I can do something to, I don't know, to protect privacy, to work against the data silos, to make it possible that people can communicate without a middleman somehow, and in an encrypted way, in a secure way, to basically, I don't know, to influence society with software. So this is the whole idea of like Nextcloud since the beginning. So that's my personal mission somehow.
Okay, I'm with you. As someone who thinks about this, so how does and maybe it's not Nextcloud, maybe it's the next thing that you work on, but how do we do it? How do we get there from a technical standpoint?
So first of all, when you said earlier that Nextcloud are just like lots and lots of data silos. I mean, this might be true, but the fact that there are like whatever, 500,000 data silos is already better than one. But of course, I agree that the data silo is not the goal. So because of that, we try to have like federation features since a long time. And I agree that not everything is perfect yet. there's still a lot of work to be done. But there are some things that is they're already implemented and they're used and they're working. So the first thing is that it's possible since several years that you have federated sharing of files. So I don't want to talk about the details of Nextcloud too much, but if you click on a file and then you can say, I want to share this file with someone else, I can type in the address of your server, and then this file or this folder is shared peer-to-peer between our servers. So the idea is that this creates like a network of servers, and there is no central node. There's no central instance. It's a bit similar like email, where we can all send each other email, but email is not owned by anyone. And actually there are like different implementations of the servers and of the clients, but because they all speak the same protocol, they're all compatible. And this is what we try to imitate with exchange of files. And that's already in Nextcloud for several years.
So are you talking about when you are in Nextcloud and you can right click and you can say share this file? Is that what you mean? Because I didn't realize that would actually go to any other server. I thought it was just you can download it.
Yeah, there are different ways. I mean, first of all, you can type in just a username, and then it looks for users on the same server, and then it's just shared with them. Then you can also create a share link, and you can send this link to someone by mail or chat or something. Then you can type in an email address. And then your Nextcloud service automatically sends basically a share link to this person by email. But you can also type in the federated sharing ID. It's a bit of a stupid name. And this is username at server instance.
Oh, I didn't know that. So you can do... Yeah. Oh, I wasn't aware. That's actually very... Is that new? Because I wasn't aware
of
that. Oh, wow.
It's like four or five years old.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's
and then if I, if I would know your host name of your Nextcloud, I can type in, your username, at symbol, and then your server. And then my server would send like with an API that we implemented, a ping to your server and say, hey, this guy from this other server wants to share something with you, and then you have the opportunity to say yes or no. And then if you say yes, then there's some keys exchange for the encryption first, but then the file shows up on URN too. And if you edit it, it changes on my side and the other way around.
Wow, so it does synchronization too. Wow, that's amazing. I had no idea that was actually a thing in Nextcloud.
I need
more Nextcloud using friends, I guess, because I don't know where that was. Because I was aware that, you could share a file, and, for the really geeky listener, that's an object capability what you're sending. You're sending them a read or edit capability to your system. But I wasn't aware that you also had the system-to-system protocol. That's really powerful.
And this is something that... a colleague of mine here at Nextcloud, Björn, and me came up with, like, I think 5 years ago or longer. And this, we implemented that. And then a lot of other companies also got interested in this kind of protocol. And there is a group now that basically standardized this protocol. And it has a name now. It calls Open Cloud Mesh, OCM. And that's a standard, and it's actually implemented by other vendors. I mean, OwnCloud also implemented it. Well, I mean, because it was implemented in the OwnCloud time, so it's still there. And then other software like C-File and Pydio, which are also free software alternatives, they support the same protocol. So you can also do this between different software, because similar to different mail servers.
That is interesting. I've been, for people who don't listen every week, right? I or whatever, how often we put this out. You know, I've been working with Chris on a secure file exchange protocol called Data Shards. So, knowing about and reading about other protocols is super useful for the way I think about things.
But what you do is very boring. So it's less. I mean, I'm sure what you do is a lot more sophisticated, because what we do is just. I mean, there are like a handful. Yeah, I think a handful of REST calls, and it just like pings this other system. Say, here's something. Here's a share invitation, and here's the access key and some other things. And then you say yes or no, and after that it's just a WebDAV mount, right? You basically say, oh, here's the endpoint, here's your key to access this resource, and then it's just a WebDAV connection over HTTPS, and that's all. I mean, it's quite boring. I mean,
but it's also exciting. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's always like, you know, there's a lot of boring technology that's in our house that works every day, right? Like, you know, oh, that electricity thing, oh, that's boring. No one's changed that for 100 years, right?
Right.
That's okay. It still powers lights. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're on the right track too, because you also support ActivityPub. I'll be honest with you, I don't use the ActivityPub module in Nextcloud because it's not as
basic.
It's a little basic, but the fact that it's there is already powerful, and I think that there's opportunities going forward to add more features on top of it, because now you've got the base libraries built in, so you can put other things, you can layer other things on top of it.
That's the plan.
I think for many of us in free software, you know, I was really excited to have you to have you agree to be a guest, because there's really, you know, I remember when Red Hat was really small, because I was actually at a dinner once and we had everybody from Red Hat except for one person at one dinner table at an install fest. Yeah. And I even remember that the year after that, I was at LinuxConf, which was like a Linux conference at the time, and like roasted marshmallows with Bob Young. He probably won't remember me, right? But like, and then I remember him, and I'm terrible with names, but the MySQL guy and Bob Young kind of went off to the side. Is that how you pronounce it? Yeah, went off to the side. Moti. And he was telling, and Bob asked, "Oh, where is the name of, you know, why is it called MySQL?" And he goes, "Oh, and they talked about, you know, his daughter." It was really like, one day this is going to be really interesting to tell someone, right? And here I am, because that was 1998, and so a long time ago, and you know, this, you know, these, I forget why I thought that was important now. Where are we going?
But that's, by the way, about the story with MySQL, that's very interesting, because a lot of people think that it's called MySQL because it's like MySQL. It's actually the name of his daughter. And Maria, because that's his fork, right? MariaDB is actually the name of the second daughter.
Right. I think there was a Max in between.
That's possible.
There was something. Yeah, it was like his son or something. that's what it was, because Red Hat is kind of an exception, right? Most of the companies that are in the free software space are not really truly 100% free software, right? So, you know, Canonical is not really 100% free software. It's a free software supporting company. It does good things, but it's not a full 100% free software company. And, you know, Red Hat and Nextcloud are really the shining stars. I know there are a couple of others, but you two are really the shining stars of this and showing how it can be done. I'm going to give you only. I think that there are still some places that we need to think about, which is how do we do it when the product is less enterprisey. Right. So when you have a product that's maybe not used by big companies. Can we make a model that fits that? And I think that's still a challenge that we need to figure out.
I agree. There are a lot of things that come together with Nextcloud that that are success factors. And I mean, that one of the success factors is something that you want to have a product that works like for a home user with like on a Raspberry Pi at home, because that's what you need to become make it popular and to like have volunteers to improve the software and everything. But it also needs to be software that's also usable for the million employee company, because this is where you can, that is where you get the money. So yeah. That's not, that's weird. And I still think from time to time that it's quite weird that we somehow manage to have the Nextcloud architecture in a way that exactly the same code actually works on the Raspberry Pi than on a huge cluster for a million people. That's quite, that's weird.
It's very challenging, yeah. And it's, yeah. And I think that that's where we're, you know, but I definitely see Nextcloud as being a leader, not just in the technology space, but especially in the philosophical space in free software and development. So, and look, I think one of the success factors is you, you know, in the leadership and thoughtfulness that you've put into building this company, into not just being another open core business.
Well, I mean, I'm the public spokesperson. That's true, but I mean, we have so many good people at Nextcloud in the company, in the community. And I mean, it's really a community thing. I mean, I said earlier that I wrote OwnCloud 1.0 alone. And this is like, basically, there's no software left that I wrote, basically. And that's good because there's so many better developers now and so many better people with APIs and with marketing and sales. And I mean, it's a really a group thing. So it's not, people only see me because I'm doing podcasts like that.
Well, of course, you're the CEO and you're the face of the company. Obviously, there are many, many people that make it successful. And there are many factors, but I think that one of the ones that really does stick out is the fact that you and your team stuck to their philosophical guns when moving from OwnCloud to Nextcloud and took a big risk, a personal risk of finance and your uprooting your lives to build this thing. Yeah. You could have stayed. You could have stayed and just made your money and been, you know, moderately happy.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, yeah, sure. And work for Google or Facebook, as I said before, and make a lot more money than we ever make here with Nextcloud.
Yeah.
I mean, sure. But I mean, that's, as I said before, I mean, I don't know. The goal can't, for me, the goal is not to like die rich or something, right? You want to really do something meaningful. This is what we're trying to do. And about the philosophical thing, by the way, that's not only me. I mean, that's like really the whole team. I mean, we have like people who are involved in the free software, in the Free Software Foundation Europe, for example, or people who really care about diversity. This is something we try to push forward here with Nextcloud, and about decentralization and privacy. I mean, there's so many. We are really a group of idealists. So it's not only like me and the others are just like developers, but I do something. We really think a lot about the mission, and that's quite important.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing all this. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you're like, oh, I really actually want to
A million things. Maybe there's one thing about the technology, actually about the federated sharing, that I want to add maybe quickly. Because when we talked that we have this protocol in place where you can do federated sharing. And you mentioned that you didn't know that because you don't see it in the user interface, and you have to type in this weird ID of, you first have to ask another person, hey, what's the name of your Nextcloud server and your username and blah, blah, blah. And that's a bit weird. And that's something that, I mean, that's not good enough, because we are competing with Google Drive and Dropbox and other centralized services where, you can just type in whatever the name of your grandma, and then you get some auto completion, and you say boom, and then your grandma has like your vacation photos, right? And that's something that's tricky if you're federated.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. It's funny you mentioned that, because you know, Chris and I were talking not that long ago about one of the future episodes. And, you know, we were talking about something that we've mentioned in a very early episode called Zuko's Triangle, which I'm sure you're aware of. And we were talking about how the news is finally starting to nibble around this discussion of, you know, DIDs, distributed identifiers, and how and then, you know, pet names and how pet names fit into that. Because ideally, right, when you said, oh, I'd really like to share it with grandma, maybe you shouldn't have to know grandma's ID. Maybe you should just be able to type grandma.
And so
I think that you're right. That's an area where we really need to get better. And free software needs to work on improving these distributed identifiers and making them easier to use. It's something that I'm personally interested in.
And that's really
exploring more in the future.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that, in my opinion, this is really the next big challenge, because just people seem to focus on the pure, I don't know, something like blockchain or whatever, even our API where you have like this distributed hash table, so we can something like that, which is, from my perspective, only like the technology part, which is not enough, because we really should have to care about the user experience and how this becomes really usable for my grandma. And we at NextCloud, we did some experiments. For example, we have a feature built in also since a few years where it's a bit similar to GPG key servers, where on your profile you can actually say, I want to be found by other people. And then it's basically like a public phone book. And then you can say, hey, people should be able to find me by name, or people should be able to find me by email address or by Twitter handle or some other things. And then your data is like published to this public phone book somehow. So we're trying to experiment with that. And there are many, many, many other things. But I want to, at the end of the podcast, even like challenge everybody even more, because if we implement all of that in a perfect way, and you can type in grandma, as you mentioned, and then my vacation photos is shared with my grandma, then we only achieved user experience parity with these big data silos. Then we can do the same than Facebook and Google. But that's not enough. We need to be better. This is what we do here with like federating and decentralizing the cloud services. We need to be better than those silos.
I agree.
Being just good, just the same is nice, but that's not enough. And that's a big challenge. So that's the last thing I want
to mention. That's a good challenge to our audience to think about what they're working on and how they can work on this. It's something I think a lot about. So thank you so much, Frank. So I'm gonna end with the, you know, thank you very much for coming. If you or anyone else would like to join our ongoing conversation, we're on IRC, we're #LibreLounge on Freenode. If you're on the Fediverse, we are at LibreLounge at floss.social. We're on Twitter at LibreLounge. You can also email us podcast@LibreLounge.org. And hopefully soon Chris will be back and we'll be diving into some of these topics actually pretty soon. So thanks so much, Frank. Thank you for coming.
Thanks a lot. It was really fun. And as I said, you're my favorite podcast. So it's awesome. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at LibreLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joth, which is waived into the public domain under CC0 and which you can find on opengameart.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.